Something on the part of the person who doesn't get to go on stage to do it. And ever since, I've been reminded of that by the fact that I don't go to clubs. I can't stand clubs, but I work in them all the time. And I fill up and people come, and I don't know where these people come from because it's not anything I can do. And so, when I got the chance to play here at a place I've been hearing about for 30 years. I jumped in. Welcome. I do have to tell you, there's only one place I won't play. That's in Bloomington, Indiana. Thank you.
To it.
tune, a guy named Dave. I think of him as an attendant at an insane asylum because that's really what he did for a living for a while. Working largely in rock and roll with as a tour manager and a sound engineer. And it wasn't that he soothed the fraught psyches of these artsy types. It was that he abraded the otherwise tranquil mood of a, you know, fairly obnoxious rock and roll band. He had a way of reaching guys who had really stiff upper lips and turning them into whining, really mean people. This is, you know, I don't know who you go to verify this, but you just have to take my word for it. And Dave would probably concur because he enjoyed it and he's not ashamed of what he could do. We're put on this earth with at least one gift and something to learn, and we have to share the gift, which in his case was being a brazier. I have to say for him that he is willing to learn, as far as I can tell. Still one of the best friends I've got. Fortunately, he's in another state. There's a saxophone player in Lyle Lovett's band who calls the people that he knows in any given town 1 hour before the bus is leaving. I said, Dave presided over, I can't say this with any certainty, maybe he wasn't the guy, but Procol Harum, who first took me to Europe, and then again, and gave me a whole career over there, and wrote some of the greatest music that I know of, had Dave on the second tour for a tour manager, and he was doing his usual worst. It always sounded good, but it was really tough, you know, it was hard to... By the way he could get away with all this is that he was very funny, and he was usually right. That was how he could be abrasive. But the band had decided that they were, and I wasn't there, but Gary told me this, that they needed a little goose in the technological department, and they decided to have more of a stage production. Up until this point, they'd just gone on and played and figured that was it, which is it, but they wanted more. And so they're playing the last concert, I believe it was the last concert as the original outfit, that they played in London was in Albert Hall, and they had they were ready for some visual effects, which I'd like to think Dave was responsible for, because it was after this that Dave went to the Berklee School of Music and studied staging for 2.5 years. He saw maybe, a weak spot in his skill array, and they had one of these. What's occurred to me, a lot of people don't know about these. It's a projection screen. You know, it's a tube, you pull it up, you hang on a little hook, it's beaded, it shines in the light, you show movies on it. That was behind the band. That was their, that was going to be their entry into high tech. And somewhere there was one of these carousel slide projectors that goes whir, clunk, whir, clunk, whir, clunk. And each clunk was a new image. You know, your uncle fishing. And after about 3 whir clunks, their career was over. Thank you. Chicago, or at least some of the playing around here, than I do about even the streets in my hometown. Which is, you know, none of which is, I mean, you don't need to know any of that. It's all kind of resonating in me as we speak. Doesn't take much, I'll resonate.
Thank you.
for my acting right. Not, I don't write any of these for anybody or for any reason. Anytime I start wandering off on that tack, it's a lie. It just seems that way to me sometimes, but I can't do it that way. I mean, I can't write. I won't write "We Are the World." If I do, I'm you know that I run out of stuff. I don't know how. I know a lot of people can do that. They think, "Oh, yeah," and then they write. I don't. What happens for me is I'm doing that all the time, and every now and then I'll get something, a chord. And I think, I just wait. That's what I do. I was waiting my way through this thing, and I remembered my friend Sveta Kavčar, who told me this story about her dad and her life in Slovenia, in Ljubljana, where I was standing at the time she told me this. It's a long story and a horrible story, and I've learned that if I go all the way into it, some people just don't recover, and so it's supposed to be entertaining, that I'm not a suicide mode, so I won't go all the way into it, but I'd just like to tell you one little bit, which is that she had the most explosive and incendiary temper of any human I've known. It was just remarkable what would set her off, which was nothing. Nothing. And we were, for example, although this is something, but we were wandering around town one day on one of these tours I used to do all the time. It was a beautiful country. It was a really gorgeous place. And we're wandering around, and the high schools, or whatever the equivalent was, had graduated their a couple classes that day. And they were segregated by sex, and the uniform for girls was a blue t-shirt that hung down below your knees, about halfway below your knees. It was a kind of an olive oil look. And there was a bunch of them, and they were congealed. It's like they're packed in a can, and they were moving in a bunch like this through town, wandering right down through the middle of Ljubljana. And they were singing, they're all about 15, 16 years old, and they were singing "Oh, Susanna." I looked at this, and I figured they'd be arrested any minute. And then I looked at Sveta, who always had a take on anything in the country. She lived there and hated it, after all. And she said, "If the Russians don't kill us, we'll kill each other." I knew better than to say something like, "What's that, just singing a song?" You didn't confront her. I mean, you were grateful enough to be on the receiving end of the recent explosion and sort of entertained as you watched the shell go off somewhere else. And I lost contact. I lost touch with her during all of the wars. And I recently found her again. She's in Germany doing a production that involves dance and collage. So she's still really pissed off. Thank you. Son doing here. I never have figured that out. And, you know, years later, I'm plunking away doing whatever, and I walked into a store in L.A. Owned by Fred Wallach. He's one of the great sort of brokers, guitar brokers in this country. He's really good at it. He finds great instruments, and he only sells them to people who know what they are and will both play them and take care of them. Pretty extraordinary guy. And, you know, to engage in him in business, you have to give him, your firstborn and a lot of money and all that kind of thing. But a lot of people do. And I went down there and I found a 12-string made by Roy Whitebook. Roy? Whitebook was his last name, who was a great builder, and he built these cedar top guitars that had a really cushy sort of sound, which is really hard to get on a 12 string, and that's what this was. It sounded great. And a couple years later, I was back in talking to Fred, and he said, Ryan Cooter was looking at that guitar. I said, yeah, I know, Ryan. He said, he left to think about it. You came in, bought it. He came back and said he wanted it. The next time I saw him, I said, I have your guitar. And Fred also told me, that guitar used to belong to Art Linkletter's son. To be the case. All the other stuff is just an excuse to do that. They won't let you do that for very long until they tell you, wait, isn't there any more? Listen, I think this is enough for most people. I think for Bill Evans sitting down at the piano, he'd have. That's enough for him. I know it is. It's enough for me, unfortunately. There's a reason for this, and that is that I played a trombone for many years before I found the guitar, and you can't do this with a trombone. You throw a guitar down a flight of stairs, it makes a beautiful sound. You really throw a trombone down a flight of stairs, I dare you. It sounds like a rat you threw down there. Snap, crackle. I went out to hear people. I heard Rafael Mendez, who was a trumpet player, who had a strange niche for players. There was a Lovardo or somebody like that who played alto saxophone. And these guys would travel the country playing with high school bands as the guest artist for the year. Poor guys, Can you imagine? They hit that perfect cadenza and the band goes behind them. That was... I tried to hear Carlos Montoya in Tulsa, and I didn't like it, and I couldn't barely hear the guy. Just recently I saw Anne-Sophie Mutter playing some Beethoven with the orchestra in the town I live in, and two guys behind me kept talking about her gown and would not shut up. I appreciate the fact that you're here, That's what I'm still getting at that. It's not, I went out to see, and that's what I want to do here with this tune, I went out in D.C. when I was living, we moved there from Oklahoma my last year of school, and I went to see John Hurt play, and he was wearing his hat that a lot of you probably are familiar with. It held his skull together, that kind of dirty. It didn't look good, and it was never off his head, and that's why it held his skull together. That's my, it has to be so. And he came out to play, And he sat down, and there's a little tiny place, and his wife was sitting right here, and she looked worse than his hat did. And that's, that has to be said, because as he was doing this tune, everybody does this tune. Everybody has their own way through it. Every now and then, he would look down at his wife and smile. And this smile, you can see it in some photographs, is the most radiant smile I've ever seen, I used to say, on a human being. But where else would it be? It's just a dazzling, I mean, radiant is not too big a word. He had, I think, as I recall, two teeth, one up, one down, and he beamed this smile. It's not the equipment, it's the intent, I guess. Her. And she would look back at him in that hat and give him one of those. And I knew, everybody in the room knew, they had something we would never have.
Thank you.
I played this in Annapolis recently and realized and learned from the engineer that, like me, because I started talking about this fact that I had drowned four times in my life, that he had two. This guy had four near-death experiences. Well, his were a little closer than mine were. And I'll just give you one of them. He was drilling, you know, an electric drill. He was standing in a lake drilling a dock together. I told him, "You're my kind of guy." And he said, you know, so he got zapped and he flopped. He's underwater, but he's only about that far under. And he, you know, he's bossing, and he can see the air up there, but he can't get to it. And this is what we agreed on, which is that he doesn't really. One of mine, just one of the four, was Boy Scout camp, which is a. It's like going to Kosovo. Nobody should go to a Boy Scout camp. You gotta bring that crap up. I bet everybody in this room knows somebody who had his eye put out with a stick, or someone who fell off a cliff, someone who got bit by a snake, and all kinds of, forget the broken legs and arms and necks and backs. It all happened right at Boy Scout camp. Because they had a better idea what we should be doing instead of letting the scout troop roll the, you know, roofing tar out into heavy traffic that they found on top of the church where you have your meeting. No, you gotta go out in the woods and kill each other. You gotta drown, stab yourself with a knife because they don't let you have a beer can and you don't know how to open it because it's there. They should just stay away from us when we're that little. Leave us alone. So there we were, sitting at scout camp. All this stuff had happened. A guy had gotten his eye out with a stick already. And they said, "Well, we're going to go out on rafts today. We're going to go out on the river." Oh, boy. So he treads down to the river, and you get in the rafts, and the river is moving about that fast, you know. And he's, you know. So, what do? You start punching each other. Now, you do what you would have done on your own if they left you alone, but in much safer circumstances. Now, you're doing it on a river, in the wilderness somewhere. And I got, you know, and you punch like that. And it's none, you know, none of that. It's just, and somehow, I probably just sit here, right here, and somebody got me, and I went over, and the raft went over me, and I thought, well, I'll wait till the raft moves, but I was a speed bump, is what I was. And I realized, no, I'm not, the raft isn't going anywhere, a lot like it was to begin with. Now it's over me, it's not going to move until I'm gone, and I'm not going to be gone probably till I'm dead. And then, you know, I was drowning in that much weather, people stepping on me. And I said to this guy, I said, you know, I don't remember how I got out of that. And sometimes I think, maybe I didn't. I said, how would you know? You know, and I looked at him, I said, who are you? You know, where are you going here? And he said, right. He couldn't remember how to get out of the lake after being electrocuted. Which did leave us, though, with a dilemma, which is, if it is true, then who am I, you know? Well, it goes on and on. These things you don't want to think about too much. Whatever you do, don't drown. So I'll play this. I wrote this in Australia while my room was flooding. I wasn't drowning, but it's, you know, I'm sensitized now. It's called Snorkel. And thank you again for coming out.
Lord.